The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thanks, folks. I just to start off the presentation today, I just wanted to say a couple things about sort of the political context around Israel-Palestine. Try to situate this discussion within the current context. There's, I think, three recent events that have been compressed in a relatively short amount of time that have contributed to Israel having a giant PR black eye that's been largely self-imposed just in the past few years. Let's just think about it so we can get on the same page. One, after Hamas won was elected in 2006, the imposition of a siege in Gaza, which has, you know, received a lot of attention. It's led to a humanitarian crisis, denial of crucial medical food supplies. There's that. The second sort of watershed PR black eye that Israel's given itself was the war in Gaza, Operation Cast Lead, the winter of 2008-2009. The whole world watched as Israel bombed and conducted chemical warfare against the population that, first of all, was under siege, as I mentioned, but also couldn't go anywhere. I mean, was immobile. And then the third event, just last year, about 14 months ago, when Israel attacked a humanitarian aid flotilla, the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, and in particular, a murderous attack on the Mavi Marmara, which was the Turkish ship that was part of the flotilla, killed 9 people, including one U.S. citizen. And just in passing, I'll note that everyone should be following the happenings right now with the current Gaza Freedom Flotilla. I don't think we're going to have much time to speak about it in the presentations, but if people have information about where that stands, I think that would be good to hear, because people are, again, heroically trying to break the siege of Gaza. This time around, Israel hasn't attacked any of the ships yet, but they have conducted sabotage against several, and as of now, they've colluded with the Greek government to actually stop the humanitarian aid vessels from leaving the docks in the Mediterranean to reach Gaza. They've colluded with basically the arch budget cutters of the Greek government to stop humanitarian aid from reaching the besieged people of Gaza. So as a result of these events, these fairly horrific things, which, like I said, have been compressed in a pretty short amount of time, you see all over the world more and more people willing and actually taking much more of a critical stance, thinking more critically about Israel-Palestine, and actually siding with the Palestinians. Opinion poll after opinion poll, even in the United States, shows a thaw in opinion about the nature of Israel and about its treatment of the Palestinians. And it's a major political opening that we find ourselves in. And then second of all, correspondingly, you know, related to that, this is something Abby's going to talk much more about, but the growth of a Palestine solidarity movement that has the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement sort of at its centerpiece, the growth of that in recent years is a testament to the fact that not only are more people grappling with this issue and starting to side with the Palestinians, but you actually see more people willing to move into political activity, which is crucial in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle. So within this political context, within this opening to engage around, you know, solidarity with the Palestinians, there's going to be, I think, more activists. We're going to have to grapple with what I think is a million-dollar question, which is, in light of the PR, in light of all these things that have given Israel such a large PR black eye, that have lost it so much legitimacy, why does our government, why does the United States continue to unconditionally back Israel? You know, Israel is literally hemorrhaging legitimacy and credibility in the eyes of the world. Why does our government, under a liberal administration, continue to back it to the point where the State Department, just a few days ago, released a statement that condoned ahead of time an Israeli violent attack on a U.S. aid flotilla with American citizens on it? I mean, it's a baffling, it's something that we should grapple with. And that's sort of what I want to focus on. And as the title of the talk suggests, we're going to briefly look at the relationship between the Israeli state and U.S. imperialism to start to try to answer that question. And we're going to put forward and briefly develop the following analysis, that the Israeli state and also the Zionist pre-state that preceded it in historic Palestine is the result, one, of a process of colonization and dispossession of the indigenous Palestinians, but two, and crucially for our discussion, that this process of colonization, ethnic cleansing, dispossession of the Palestinians, which, by the way, isn't a historical relic. There wasn't an original sin of Israel of ethnic cleansing. Every time you turn on the news and you see new announcements of housing settlements in East Jerusalem or in the West Bank, which is Palestinian land, there's a continuum there of ethnic cleansing and colonization. So there's that. But two, and crucially, this process, since for 9 decades, this process has been facilitated, cultivated, completely backed and armed by larger imperialist powers on the world stage. And when you talk about that, broadly speaking, that means two powers. It was Great Britain for a period of time, and then for decades, it's been the United States. It's been our government. One sec. So, Zionism, or the idea of a Jewish homeland in Palestine, does hinge itself on the necessity of a removal of the Palestinians. People should check out Sherry Wolfe's talk, The Myths of Zionism. There's other talks that'll go more into that. But the idea of Zionism, of a Jewish state in historic Palestine, really got its foot in the door. I mean, there was a movement starting in the late 1880s, 1890s, but it really got its foot in the door as an actual process when, at the end, it's sort of situated in some of the politics of the World War I era. Great Britain was one of the European, was one of the victorious European colonial powers coming out of World War I. And what the victorious European colonial powers did was they sat down as part of and basically carved up the Middle East. Basically took bits and pieces of the carcass of the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East and took little parts for themselves. Britain, you know, took Palestine. That fell under their dominion. And in 1917, they issued what's called the Balfour Declaration. And Balfour was Great Britain's promise to the Zionist movement to establish a Jewish state, or a Jewish sort of a protectorate of Great Britain in historic Palestine. And the irony of Balfour was that it was actually issued by a pretty anti-Semitic... Balfour was a very anti-Semitic British politician. Great Britain didn't agree to this, didn't commit itself to this for any moral reasons or because it, you know, it felt like it was the right thing to do. It was cold, hard political calculation in terms of the potential for benefits for the British Empire to set up a client, sort of satellite in historic Palestine. And actually, I'll just quote one of the founders of the Zionist movement who was active and a leader of the movement at the time of the Balfour Declaration. And he sort of expands on the role that a Zionist, that Zionism could play for Great Britain. He said, and he's sort of addressing himself to British politicians at the time, "During a dangerous moment in the war, World War I, you thought that we could render you a useless service. You turned to us, making promises that were rather general but could be considered satisfactory." He's referring to the Balfour Declaration that I just mentioned. "We considered your views and were loyal towards your proposals. We only want to continue. We made a pact with you. We consider carefully the dangers and commitments of the pact." And this is sort of the crucial part. "We know what you hope to receive from us. We must protect the Suez Canal for you. We shall be the guards of your road to India as it passes through the Middle East. We are ready to fulfill this difficult military role, but this requires that you permit us to become powerful so as to be able to fulfill our role. Loyalty for loyalty, faithfulness in return for faithfulness." So this was a breakthrough for the project of the colonization of Palestine. The Zionist movement had been looking for patrons, colonial patrons, to help facilitate the process. They had been turned down by other powers. Great Britain came along. Great, now there's a patron that can help facilitate the process. And they consciously, it was consciously an attempt to supply an essential service to British colonialism. You heard it. Protection of the Suez Canal, the most important shipping route in the Middle East, and a route to India, another major British possession of the British Empire. So you see, from the start, the Zionist colonial settler movement was attached to imperialism literally by the umbilical cord. I mean, the relationship we see today with a very cozy relationship to our government isn't something that just came out of nowhere. So just to fast forward a couple decades in the interest of time here, after World War II, the sort of the big dog on the world stage was the United States. It was really one of the only powers that hadn't had its industrial base bombed. It was in a much, much stronger position to start to muscle its way for influence in the Middle East. In the Middle East, in the mid to late 40s, early 50s, there was a realization that it was going to become a real hotspot and a real point of scramble between the various imperialist powers. And there's, if you boil it down to the essence of why that was, it is basically related to oil. In the mid 1940s, 30% of all the world's oil resources were found in the Middle East, but only 6% of oil production and refinement was found in the Middle East. So if you sort of put yourself into like that cold imperialist framework, you know, where would you want to establish a foothold? Where would you want to sort of position yourselves in the broader game? The Middle East was absolutely a hot spot. Harold Ickes, an American petroleum administrator, said, "The capital of the oil empire is on the march to the Middle East. The United States had better move there in a big way and fast." So establishing a foothold, establishing a status quo that was friendly to U.S. imperialism, you know, it meant a couple. It meant cultivating, you know, throughout the decades, sort of a network of proxy regimes, regimes that are, you know, repressive regimes that are very loyal to the United States, back the United States. You know, Saudi Arabia comes to mind, you know, Egypt under Mubarak certainly comes to mind, but Israel was also a very important part of this process, of the U.S. establishing a status quo that would be friendly to its interest in a region of the world so rich in oil resources. You know, that when Israel was established in 1948, aid started flowing from the United States, you know, fairly immediately. The United States supported it. It was, you know, this is similarly to what the British Empire was thinking about the potential for benefits. But, you know, the real sort of largesse, the real injection of aid on a mass scale didn't really start from the United States until after the 1967 war. This was when Israel crushed the combined might of the Arab armies, you know, that was headed by Nasser, the project of Arab nationalism. Nasser's armies were beaten up by Israel. And Israel proved its usefulness and its ability to basically stop the process of Arab nationalism. Arab nationalism was dealt a crushing historic defeat that it's recently actually recovering from, only in a different form. I'll just make that in passing. We should talk more about that. But it was crushed, and Israel showed that it could be a very effective, extremely effective watchdog for imperial interest. Because if you're the United States, what do you not want in the Middle East? You don't want self-determination. What does self-determination mean? It means people being able to democratically control their own resources. 1967 was a watershed moment. Israel started to receive massive amounts of aid, and it still receives anywhere between $3 to $5 billion a year from the United States. And if you think about it, it's a great deal for U.S. imperialism. Because it's influence on the cheap, relatively. Because you can have a state that you arm and back that'll do your bidding to an extent, instead of having to permanently occupy countries or, you know, just have a corridor of military bases. Israel has been very useful for the United States in that regard. Actually, I got a quote here. A spokesperson for the Israeli Foreign Office was also, you know, sort of articulated this. This is a statement from the late 60s. "The United States has come around to the conclusion that it can no longer respond to every incident around the world, that it must rely on a local power, the deterrent of a friendly power, as a first line to stave off America's direct involvement. Israel feels it fits that definition." I mean, you could have copy and pasted that from what they said about Great Britain, you know, in 1917 at the end of World War I. You know, the imperial patron changed. Not everything was necessarily, but the central dynamic of Israel serving as a watchdog for a dominant imperialist power on the world stage was the same. That's why the $3 billion that Israel gets from our government a year, you know, even as Israel's quickly becoming a pariah state, it's not a mistake. It's not something that's going to be corrected short of a mass social movement. It's structurally built into the way U.S. imperialism has built a status quo in the region that's friendly to its interests. So, and the Palestinians are caught in the middle of this vice. They're caught in the middle. They're caught in the middle of the vice of the U.S. Washington relationship. Where am I for time? Oh, great! I'll just wrap up with a few more thoughts. I know I touched on that kind of briefly, a lot of the history, but there's been some discussion of if people read Omar Barghouti's book, the first chapter sort of goes into this, and there's also been discussion of, you know, with Israel becoming such a pariah for the United States, you know, is it more of a liability for U.S. imperialism than it is a benefit? And I think it's an interesting discussion, but we should, and, you know, under the Obama administration, is, you know, Obama and Netanyahu have butted heads a couple times, one around settlements. You know, Biden was in Israel last year, was embarrassed by an announcement that Israel was going to build new settlements in East Jerusalem. There's been a little bit of friction. Obama recently gave a speech that didn't have much actual content to it, but he mentioned, like, a Palestinian state and was reprimanded by Netanyahu. So there has been a little bit of friction, and it's notable, and it's something that we should keep in mind in the current political opening. But I don't think we should confuse short-term tactical disagreements, little diplomatic skirmishes, for some sort of fundamental strategic realignment that's gonna take place. The United States and Israel have had small skirmishes before. I mean, this isn't the first time. And what we should say is that, you know, if the Obama administration was serious about stopping the construction of settlements, or was serious in any way about upholding the Palestinian rights according to international law, they could just cut off the aid. You know, we're taught from an early age that you've got to judge people not based on what they say, but based on what they do. And this administration has been no different in terms of its support for Israel and its war crimes against the Palestinians. So, in a sense, Israel, it's a contradictory situation, because Israel is absolutely a watchdog for U.S. imperialism in the Middle East. You know, and stability, in quotation marks, which is talked a lot about in the Middle East, Israel is an important part of that. But it's contradictory because Israel also sets off tension. And stability in the Middle East for decades has covered up massive social inequality, real political yearning for independence of U.S. imperialism and Israeli penetration into historic Palestine. So it's a contradictory situation. So you'll see tension. It doesn't change the relationship of the United States and Israel. And I think we should keep that in mind. And then the big political implication that I think it has for our movement, for people who are becoming Palestine solidarity activists, the type of discussions we want to have, the type of political education we want to carry out, is that, you know, in the United States, if you're a Palestine solidarity activist, you're not just on a political collision course with the occupation of Palestine and with Zionism, you're actually on a political collision course with U.S. imperialism. I mean, that's absolutely the case. And I think the anti-war movement, the Palestine solidarity movement, should keep that in mind as we go forward and try to build a movement, justice for the Palestinians, but also build a movement for self-determination for all people in the Middle East. So thanks.
So let me start by just saying how pleased I am to be here. And I want to thank the organizers of the ISO for inviting me. I'm from Canada, from the International Socialist there, and I'm also on the coordinating committee of the Coalition Against Israeli Apartheid. But I need to add the proviso that I'm speaking on my own behalf, and I'm just really glad to be sharing this panel. So what I want to talk to you about is the notion of the context of apartheid and repression that's happened against the term apartheid and the movement against apartheid and how it's associated with the BDS movement. John Grayson is a Canadian filmmaker, writer, and gay rights activist and a professor at York University in Toronto. And in July 2010, he produced a video called Vuvuzela. You can get it on YouTube. And it's a short video that very cleverly portrays the growing participation of musicians in the cultural boycott of Israel as a contest of soccer teams on the world stage. And simply producing and distributing the video was a radical political act, as it presents Israel as a state subject to the same type of international pressure that challenged apartheid South Africa. In June 2011, this past month, John Grayson produced another short video posted on the occasion of the boat to Gaza, titled Gaza Island. It's modeled on a kind of Gilligan's Island sort of theme, to coincide with the Freedom Flotilla 2 that John is currently on, the Canadian boat to Gaza that is nestled currently. It's being held up in Greece, and it's the boat is called the Tahrir. So the efforts to repress and discredit the idea of Israel as a state fitting the term or the descriptor of apartheid has been coordinated and relentless. Now, I know this has happened internationally, but the Canadian ruling class and the Canadian right are making a bit of a name for themselves on the global scale in terms of what they're up to. So I just wanted to map that a little bit, just to give you a sense of the context. And then on the left, on this, particularly on the socialist left, the truth is we've been a little bit unclear, or a little unclear and a little off the mark in terms of my experience, about how important this analysis of Israel as an apartheid state is. I'm talking about our experience in the Canadian context. But so we've been involved in a free speech movement to respect the right to use the term, but there's also a need to go beyond that and to actually try to look at what's underneath this degree of repression. So let me just map a little bit about the ruling class and the repression that's happened. It's been quite relentless. It's involved cutting funding of the Canadian Arab Federation, which is the main Arab organization across Canada, due to the organization's leadership speaking out against the war in Gaza. It's included banning posters on a series of university campuses around Israeli Apartheid Week, and it's included a smear campaign against the Ontario branch of the Canadian Union of Public Employees, a major public service union, which took a boycott, divestment, and sanctions position. Israeli Apartheid Week was started at the University of Toronto in Canada in 2005. It has attracted the attention of the current federal government of Canada, the Tory Stephen Harper government, before a minority, now a majority. The Minister of Citizenship and Immigration there, Jason Kenney, has spoken repeatedly about Israeli Apartheid Week as an anti-Semitic hate fest. Michael Ignatieff, who is now the outgoing leader of the former official opposition, the Liberal Party of Canada, has been competing for attacks on Israeli apartheid, to determine who is calling who the greater anti-Semite, because they're not attacking it enough. And it goes on. There's more. The Canadian Parliamentary Coalition to Combat Anti-Semitism was formed in Canada, and this is a parliamentary caucus that claims legitimacy. It's actually just a volunteer organization of parliamentarians, and what they're trying to do is develop legislation for the Canadian Parliament that would see criticism of Israel as a hate crime on the grounds that anti-Semitism fits within the hate crime model. And there was a conference called Mapping Models of Statehood and Paths to Peace at York University that had funding from the major social science funding organization in Canada, and there was an unprecedented after-the-fact review of the conference on the grounds that it was being accused of being anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the list goes on and on. Over this period, any group or individual associated with Palestine solidarity, and particularly with the BDS campaign, which identifies Israel as an apartheid state, has been particularly targeted, and it's been compared to a new McCarthyism. George Galloway, who I'm sure people have heard about, the UK anti-war former MP and activist, was banned from speaking on Canada on the grounds of his relationship to Hamas, which is on the Canadian terrorist list, and Hamas is also the elected representative of the people of Gaza. The charge was sufficiently preposterous, I mean, this never happens, that a federal court judge actually reversed a decision of the federal state and said that this was actually being motivated by political grounds and not grounds of security. And George Galloway, of course, loves an audience, and he's since come back to Canada and made quite a case out of it. It goes on. It also has affected the social movements. The 2010 organizers of the Gay Pride March, which is a huge event, brings out about a million people, banned any group from using the term apartheid last year. And the group Queers Against Israeli Apartheid was banned from participating. This resulted in a huge response from, you know, a whole series of speakers who refused to speak, or they said if they are going to speak, the first three words would be apartheid, apartheid, apartheid. And so that was reversed, but it's continued again this year, where Toronto's right-wing mayor, Rob Ford, has similarly tried to ban the QIA, Queers Against Israeli Apartheid, from participating in the march on the grounds that if they did, he would ban the march. QIA very intelligently said, we're going to fight for our right to be able to participate, which they won, and now they're saying they're not going to participate in the march and saying, if you want to ban this, you're going to have to find another excuse to us. But the point is, it just goes on and on and on. The term apartheid has been threatened with censorship, but the leader of the apartheid state, Benjamin Netanyahu, has been warmly welcomed. He came to Ottawa in May 2010 for a state visit, and it was only interrupted because he had to return to deal with the IDF's attack on the Freedom Flotilla. So clearly, what we need is a movement to ensure freedom of speech, and those of us who are Palestine activists in Canada have devoted a considerable amount of time to doing broad education movement, a broad popular education movement, to indicate why the term itself should be allowed to have the sort of light of day, and the Israeli Apartheid Week phenomenon has actually spread astronomically to campuses all across the country and internationally. The charge, however, is that to associate Israel with apartheid is to single Israel out, and this is the same as anti-Semitism, because Israel is the only Jewish state. So I want to spend a little bit of time on that argument and then look at the question of the nature of apartheid. So anti-Semitism is a form of racism that targets Jews. Now, Jews itself is an ambiguous category. In the 20th and 21st century, it's become a racialized term. It includes collectively a broad array of people who are of Jewish faith or identity or culture, and sometimes those who are of Jewish, quote-unquote, blood. It's kind of a one-drop rule. If you have a relative who's Jewish, then, you know, certainly according to the official fascist Aryan literature, I mean, if you had any Jewish blood, you were considered to be racialized as Jewish. And to assume that the backlash against the term Israeli apartheid has anything to do with defending Jewish people against anti-Jewish racism is absolutely preposterous. I mean, if you think about it for a minute, you can see that it's just preposterous. Canada's record of real anti-Semitism, as in anti-Jewish racism, is pretty explicit, and it's well known, not least marked by the refusal to allow entry of German-Jewish refugees fleeing for their lives during World War II, for which there's never been any apology or any settlement. And more recently, in terms of any type of anti-racism, you know, approach, it's bizarre to see the Harper government as an ally. I mean, this is like a government who has led the attacks on Muslims and Arabs around Islamophobia since the 9/11 phenomenon. So the repression of the freedom of expression regarding Palestine generally, and the term apartheid specifically, needs to be challenged on different grounds. We need to shift the lens here. And what I think is really threatening the Canadian lead, that what is provoking this type of attack, and among, you know, Israeli state allies internationally, is actually the effectiveness of the anti-apartheid movement. It's an effective pro-civil rights, human rights, anti-imperialist movement, and one way to stop it is by charging it with actually not being progressive but being reactionary and creating a chilly climate around people who would otherwise be sympathetic or interested in it. And the movement threatens to expose the close economic and political links between Western imperialism and the State of Israel and suggests a common cause in challenging these links between Palestinians and progressive forces internationally. So apartheid is good for business, and the anti-apartheid movement threatens this. So let's focus a little bit more on just what apartheid is. The term literally is an Afrikaans term, meaning separateness, and the policy is of legal racial separation that was identified by the South African state associated with the Nationalist Party. But there is now a widespread and expanding literature, policy, journalists, analysis, which has taken the term apartheid out of the South African context and used it more generally to look at racialized capitalism. Legally racialized capitalism. So terms like the notion of global apartheid, for example, have been used commonly without any kind of fanfare. There's an analysis of Canada that talks about Canada's economic apartheid that's developed by Grace Edward Gallabuzzi. There's no fanfare. There's only fanfare about it when it's associated with Israel. It's also associated with international law. The United Nations Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid, or the Apartheid Convention, was established specifically about the South African policy. But, like all international law, the idea is that South Africa was committing a crime that any state could take, any state could function on, and it was then, you know, the idea is it's a crime. You can either commit it or you cannot commit it. In that sense, it's a kind of it's an optimistic view of how international law operates. The same thing is true of slavery, which was developed originally around the Atlantic slave trade. It's now an international crime, or the crime of genocide, which was originally specifically about the Nazis in Germany. So the context of this is really a scientific question. Is Israel an apartheid state? You know, here's the law, here's the definition of it, here's the meaning of it. Is it an apartheid state? Well, there are different types of apartheid. There are different types of apartheid, and Israel clearly fits the bill of one specific type of apartheid. Unlike the South African case, interestingly, the name of apartheid is rejected by all the political parties in Israel, and it's commonly rejected, you know, similar by its international defenders. So but is that a method? You know, like, you know, as socialists who do analysis of the world, do we normally determine a state on the basis of what it says about itself? You know, I mean, think about that. Like, Stalinist Russia said that it was Marxist, you know? I mean, okay. George Bush said that America, you know, was democratic. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, we don't normally do this. So there's no reason to assume that Israel's apartheid identity has to be associated with it saying I'm an apartheid state or we're an apartheid state. But so then we have something I think is interesting. Here we have an apartheid state that doesn't want to say its name. That's an interesting case. That's something to look at. And there's now quite a widespread literature of different analyses of apartheid. Some people think that it started after 1967, that it's mostly based on the relationship of the occupied territories, which are identified as Pontustans. Some see it as associated with the original settlement project, which was explicitly racialized, and so on. In my view, one of the things that's interesting about Israeli apartheid is the only way you can really understand it in terms of race is if you understand that something's happened in terms of race around the Jewish question in recent times. Jews historically were racialized as non-white, as the victims of anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish racism. Karen Brodkin refers to this as less than white. In the phenomenon of becoming part of the colonial empire and part of the colonial settlement class, there is a kind of whitening process that happens of Ashkenazi European Jews in particular in historic Palestine and then into Zionist Israel, where the Palestinians become identified as the non-white, and the Jews, who have been, you know, like the despised race of the rest of the world, develop a certain amount of privilege and status associated with a capitalist project, which has historically been associated with whiteness and Christianity. Here it's associated with whiteness and Jewishness. So to understand the links between Western imperialism and the Israeli state, we really need to understand specifically Zionism. And this is, you know, I mean, there are other talks on this and so on. I like to refer to what's happening in the world today as really existing Zionism, because Zionism has taken a lot of different forms at different times. But really existing Zionism means defense of the state of Israel and legitimization of the colonial settler politics in the name of support of the Jewish people and in the face of anti-Jewish racism. So you can't really understand the particular context and the difficulty of talking about apartheid and the repression in the West without recognizing that you're going to get into some questions about the history of real anti-Semitism, of the history of when Jews were the victims of racism and how Jews are not the victims of racism but the victimizers of racism in the Israeli context. Now, this analysis is not actually that new, and there have been some Marxists who have been using this analysis, the colonial settler state analysis, which is very close to the apartheid analysis, for a long time, Maxime Rodison, Tony Cliff, and so on. But it was a minority critique, a minority sort of marginal critique. What we've seen recently happening, and this is a result of exactly the type of events that Michael was talking about, is this minority left critique is actually becoming something that more and more people are paying attention to. It's moved into more mainstream discussion. And so Israel as an apartheid state is being used as an identifier, not because it's anti-Semitic, but because it's accurate. Mm-hmm. It's really, really helpful. It shifts the lens. It changes the discussion so that rather than, you know, the Palestinians being on the defensive saying, you know, proving that they're not terrorists and so on, or for those of us who are Jewish, I'm Jewish, you know, having to continually legitimate whether we're self-haters or not. It's an interesting psychological, you know, entry into politics. I mean, to say that Israel's an apartheid state puts the Zionists on the defensive. They have to say whether it is or not, what apartheid is or not. It shifts the lens, and it gives us a lot of power just in terms of political organizing. So just to conclude, The anti-apartheid movement from Palestine took inspiration from the anti-apartheid movement against South Africa's pre-1994 apartheid system. And notably, the South African anti-apartheid leaders, Nelson Mandela, Bishop Tutu in particular, have been among the forefront of campaigners for Palestinian rights on the grounds of sort of witnessing a sort of affective identity with the racialization of the Palestinians, similar to the racialization of the blacks in South Africa. And a similar role has been adopted by advocates of certain United Nations policies, which, you know, I mean, this is the General Assembly, not the Security Council, obviously, but the General Assembly has become a place for states that do not have representation, you know, after colonization and so on and so forth, to try to claim some type of ground. And it's interesting that the International Court of Justice, which is associated with the UN policy framework, identified in 2004 that the apartheid wall or the security fence was illegal, that it was in violation of international law. And it was on the one-year anniversary of that judgment that the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement emerged in Palestine itself, among 170 civil society organizations. So there was a very smart, intelligent sort of perception that we now have international law on our side. It's not being implemented. We need basically a people's United Nations movement to be able to support it. So, you know, to my mind, for us as, for those of us who are socialists, who are anti-capitalists, this is a very exciting political development, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, the analysis of apartheid, and we can learn a great deal from it. We also have something to, you know, we can put our backs into it. We have something to contribute to it. We have ways of making those linkages effective, of expanding from it. But we need a little bit of, you know, of give and take. My own experience as a socialist in Canada for many years is I'm a student of this movement. I'm a student of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and a student of the Palestinian leadership. And in that context, those of us who have learned our politics from the global north have something really, you know, to be a bit humble about in terms of witnessing this extremely intelligent development from the South African situation to the Palestinian situation to our situation internationally. And the geographic dispersal of the movement is actually interesting because the fact that the Palestinian population does not have the right of return means that there are generations of Palestinian activists all over the world who have become sort of a kind of, you know, organized cadre of the BDS movement. And if we look to the Palestinians in the diaspora, the connection that they understand, the feeling of the anti-apartheid movement is very, very deep, and they play an extremely important role in advancing our movement, not only against, you know, Israeli apartheid, but also towards, hopefully, a world of freedom and self-determination.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.